This is a place I love to come to walk. Beautiful statues along the way. It's great for just meditating, relaxing, and trying to decompress.
I'm in the Cathedral Pines Memorial Garden in New Hampshire with Diane Cotter. It's a park to honor the military sacrifice of men and women. We're standing in front of the Women's Memorial Bell Tower. It's impressive, 180 meters tall. It was the first monument to acknowledge women's service and sacrifice. The park attendant comes out of the office to open the door of the bell tower so we can look at all the panels honoring women.
So this is the Women's Memorial Bell Tower. Each of the panels represent a level of service to the United States in some degree for women.
The large bronze panels decorate the tower's four archways.
This is Rosie the Riveter. It just shows all the industrial workers that basically served during some of the wars when the men were all overseas.
Inside the center of the room is a fountain.
And it's kind of fun to throw a quarter in there once in a while. But it also, so along with nature, also peace.
Of the nations, right?
So, We leave the bell tower to walk around the garden.
It's all pretty much a big circle. This will bring us out into the cemetery.
There are small plaques throughout the garden.
All the markings of organizations. Daughters of Penelope, Women's Army Corps, Colonial Dames. Oh, French-American war vets.
At one point, Diane moves very deliberately to a bench in the Remembrance Garden. She surprises me with what she tells me, sitting here in this quiet place.
One point in time, I had considered taking my life because the bullying and the shunning got so bad that it was unbearable, just unbearable. It's a compilation of online bullying, people targeting you directly, calling you crazy, as well as online shunning, messages that don't get returned. You're pushing so hard, you're taking a wall, a literal wall, and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, and nobody's responding, nobody's answering. They're saying crazy things about you behind your back. They're constructing to disembowel you in front of an audience because you're that crazy bitch from Massachusetts who dares speak out about this issue.
She called a friend who worked with her on her fight for firefighters and asked him to keep up her Facebook page if she left.
I think if I got a call like that from someone, it would kind of freak me out. What did he do?
Well, it put him in a terrible position because he's in California. I'm here in, you know, New Hampshire. And he asked if he should tell Paul, and I asked him not to. And then he would call me frequently, message me frequently to get a gauge for how I'm doing. And I took a little downtime.
It was thoughts of leaving her grandchildren and how her suicide would traumatize them that pulled her back from the edge.
Oh, that's a nice garter snake getting her son.
It was around this time that Diane found lawyer Rob Bilott.
I Googled PFOA DuPont attorney, and instantly that picture of Rob on the New York Times popped up, and I was very intimidated.
The New York Times article was called "The Lawyer Who Became DuPont's Worst Nightmare." It had been published a year earlier. As Diane says, very intimidating.
But regardless, I had to reach out. I began the bombardment of emails, and I think maybe about the 160th email, he replied, "Fascinating." And that one word gave me hope. So much hope. So much hope. Just that one word.
Welcome to The Poison Detectives, a production of Canada's National Observer. This podcast is made possible by the Dragonfly Fund in collaboration with the Institute of Sustainability and Education and Action. Among the Dragonfly priorities is working towards a toxic-free world for the health of people and the planet. I'm Sandra Bartlett, and this is Episode 5, Toxic Justice. By the time Diane reached out to Rob Bilott, he'd been fighting DuPont in court for almost 20 years. The cases were all about polluted rivers and streams that had contaminated drinking water. He knew about the problems with firefighting foam, but didn't know about the turnout gear.
And really, that first came to my attention by Diane Cotter calling and, you know, alerting me to this issue that these chemicals may have also been used in the turnout gear that firefighters had been using for many, many years.
I introduced myself. I introduced this issue. I asked for his help. I said, "You're literally my last chance." I said, "I've been through a number of attorneys and no one can help."
She was concerned this exposure was occurring. You know, how do we get to the bottom of it? How can we make sure that this is something that gets investigated? And, you know, I was happy to help. You know, I recognized that this was a huge potential community, firefighters, other emergency responders that really had been kept in the dark. You know, it was a public health threat.
I was sending Rob the documents, particularly from the manufacturers,
and started looking at who in our government here in the United States has responsibility for doing health studies and testing for hazardous exposures like this. And really, it comes down to the what we call the ATSDR, the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry. Sort of a mouthful, but it's a federal agency that was created back in 1980. It was empowered to give the agency the power to go out and do studies when there's been toxic exposures like that. They haven't done that much, frankly, since 1980.
And he wrote that 195-page letter to the EPA and CDC, ATSDR, and U.S. Attorney General.
That was the letter that the EPA ignored for 2 years. The ATSDR responded right away to the letter it received.
It laid out to the agency, here are the concerns that may be out there with firefighters who've been exposed to these chemicals, not only from the foam, but from their gear, and asked the agency to include them and to start studying this, these folks.
Rob wanted to start testing firefighters' blood for PFAS chemicals.
The agency decided, yeah, we are going to start looking into this. But they decided they would not include the firefighters because that was, quote, occupational exposure. And, you know, was really the subject of a different agency. It was sort of a pass the buck.
The agency also told Rob that, frankly, they didn't have the resources to do big-scale blood testing of the kind that was paid for by DuPont after his successful class action.
We're probably not even going to be able to analyze cancers because we need tens of thousands of people, and we just don't have the money to do that.
So once again, if anything was going to happen to protect people from the PFAS family, it would have to be through the courts.
So in 2018, we filed a new case in federal court in Ohio where we were seeking to represent everyone in the country who had at least PFOA, the one we already knew was linked with these different diseases, mixed with at least one other PFAS chemical like PFOS, the chemical 3M had been using in Scotch Guard and firefighting foams, and to require medical studies and testing be funded by the companies that had put these chemicals into our blood.
Did you catch that? A class action lawsuit that would represent every American. The lawsuit accused DuPont, 3M, and 8 other chemical companies and manufacturers of conducting a massive, undisclosed human health experiment. Ohio firefighter Kevin Hardwick was the front man for the lawsuit. He had been a firefighter for more than 40 years, and he used PFAS firefighting foams and wore the PFAS-contaminated turnout gear. A class action suit represents a group of people, several people, or hundreds of people, or in this case, millions of people. It was an unusual action that Rob had filed a lawsuit to include every person in the U.S. who had a detectable level of PFAS in their blood. Another unusual element of the case, it didn't ask for money for the class. Rob wanted to give people health information.
In other words, to kind of do what we had done in West Virginia with one chemical in one community, but take that and expand it to a larger national scope.
We heard about that blood study back in episode 3. 69,000 people had their blood tested for just one of the chemicals, PFOIA. The study found that the chemical was causing kidney cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis, preeclampsia, and high cholesterol.
Now we want to look at what does mixing that chemical with these other PFAS chemicals do to the entire population and help put put a mechanism in place through a court to require those studies to be done. And most importantly, to require that not the exposed people have to pay for them, but the companies making the chemicals.
The lawsuit asked for a panel of scientists to study the effects of PFAS on the body and for medical monitoring of everyone with contaminated blood. Very similar to that class action lawsuit in West Virginia and Ohio. In 2018, the population of the U.S. was 325 million. Now, if only half the people in the U.S. had PFAS in their blood, that would be medical monitoring of 175 million people. It was a pretty bold ask. But it got to the scope of the PFAS problem. It isn't just firefighters or people who live near contaminated water who are exposed. All of us are exposed to PFAS from products we've come to need.
What do pizza boxes, your outdoor gear, skis, carpets, and photo paper have in common? Probably this four-letter word, PFAS.
Today you can find lots of news and videos explaining what they are.
They do a brilliant job of repelling water, grease, and dirt, superior to any other substance, which is why nearly every branch of industry uses them.
There are over 200 different use categories of PFAS. So, for example, one of the major uses is the production of plastic and rubber. And a second major use is really in the electronic industry. For example, on your computer chips is a major place. So all of our smartphones have lots of PFAS in them.
That was Linda Birnbaum. We met her in episode 3. She worked at the National Institutes of Health and was the director of the National Toxicology Program for 10 years.
This is, again, just a simplistic kind of a nice little diagram, kind of showing the main, some of the major uses that we all run into all the time. So people don't realize that they're cosmetics, for example, waterproof mascara, waterproof lipstick, it's got PFAS in it. Your personal care products, this is your nonstick cookware or your water-resistant clothing, and fast food packaging is a big one.
Here's how one news story reported the problem.
In response to Consumer Reports, some companies stress that with PFAS so common in the environment, it's nearly impossible to eliminate them entirely.
Industry has so saturated our lives with products containing PFAS chemicals that it will be an enormous job to stop using them and get them out of the landfills and waterways and soil. Lawyer Rob Bilott describes it this way.
It has allowed the entire planet to be contaminated on a scope and scale like we've never seen before. These chemicals now permeate the air, the water, the soil, wildlife all over the entire planet, and they're now found in the blood of almost every living person on the planet, including newborns.
Rob says, like the tobacco companies, who to this day deny smoking can cause cancer, the PFAS industry is still fighting and lobbying against regulation.
What we're hearing is, because we've now contaminated the whole planet, oh, this is too big. This is too big to regulate. If you step in now, you're going to destroy the economy. So many, these chemicals have been used in so many products. So many places are impacted. So many people are impacted. In other words, we've contaminated so much and so effectively that you can't regulate this now. Too big to regulate.
And he says they expect us to pay for the cleanup.
These are completely man-made chemicals made by just a couple of companies. So when we find them in the air, the water, the soil, or in our blood, they are fingerprints back to those companies. Yet those are the same companies that are trying to avoid responsibility for this all over the planet and are trying to push those costs now onto all of us, saying essentially, well, these are just the costs of modern society. And these are costs that we all need to bear, where really these companies made billions and billions for decades, have contaminated all of us.
Linda Birnbaum says industry will start doing the right thing when regulations are in place and enforced.
I think what people don't understand that is overall, regulations that have been enforced end up saving money. They certainly save lives.
Part of the reason it's so expensive to clean up after toxic chemicals like PCBs in the past or PFAS is that the air, the water, the soil, and food gets contaminated before we even discover there's a problem. Because chemicals are considered safe until proven dangerous. As we've heard throughout this podcast, a chemical can be created and put into products without any studies testing its potential danger. On the other hand, a new drug has to be studied and evaluated by the US FDA or Health Canada before it's licensed for people to use. Like the EPA, Environment Canada has been slow to move on the thousands of PFAS chemicals. As mentioned in episode 4, the agency made a bold move back in 2006 to ban PFOIA and PFOS, with some exceptions, and then added some others in 2012. But since then, the PFAS family has grown to more than 12,000 chemicals. In May of 2023, Environment Canada put out a draft report on the idea of regulating and likely banning PFAS chemicals as a class. Environmental chemist Miriam Diamond from the University of Toronto says that could be a game changer.
I was pleased to see that in the May 2023 release of the Canada's PFAS strategy, the recommendation that PFAS be treated as a class. That's fantastic.
That would mean instead of examining PFOIA and PFOS and PFHXS and then the next and the next, the PFAS family would be treated as one class and one regulation would apply to all of them. It would be a faster approach to identifying toxic chemicals.
That's certainly not to the liking of industry. Industry does not want a class approach. They argue that each chemical is different and unique. And thank you very much for arguing that, because there are now 12,000 different chemicals that are being produced. No way that we're going to ask science on 12,000 different chemicals.
Industry is making the same arguments in Europe. The European Union, which consists of 27 countries, has been talking about a similar ban on all forms of PFAS chemicals since 2020. In February of 2023, in an attempt to speed things up, four EU countries, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, the Netherlands, along with Norway, which was not yet an EU member, put forward a detailed proposal for a ban. Industry is campaigning against the idea, warning of dire consequences for economies and supply chains. For example, the pharmaceutical industry said the ban could end the production of some drugs that use PFAS in the manufacturing process. And then there's industry's warning about the risk to the green transition. The European Chemical Industry Council raised concerns about the use of PFAS chemicals in batteries and semiconductors The council said the chemicals are essential for the green economy, electric vehicles, and renewable energy production. Florian Henkel of the German company Cellcentric said in a panel discussion on the industry that fuel cells can't be made without PFAS.
Basically, for example, fuel cells, PFAS are the functional element of the fuel cell itself. So the membrane of the fuel cell. And if you take that one out, the fuel cell can't function anymore. So basically, if we ban these substances, we will ban the entire industry of fuel cells and electrolyzers in Europe.
Now, whether it's true or not that the green transition is at risk, or the drug supply is at risk, the EU has built in exceptions for essential products that need PFAS. Companies will be given 12 years to find replacements for PFAS in their products. The public consultation period ended in September, but now there's speculation by environmentalists that industry has convinced the EU to slow down. The ban is unlikely to be voted on before 2025. Lawyer Rob Bellot isn't hopeful that despite all the media and political attention, that regulators in the EU and North America are ready to move as fast as needed.
Here we are in the year 2024, and we are just now having the federal EPA finally get to the point of announcing that they intend to regulate this same chemical in drinking water. They still haven't done that. We still haven't gotten over the threshold of actually having that one chemical that I first notified them about back in 2001. We haven't even been able to regulate that one yet, let alone all the rest of these.
And that, of course, is why he's in the courts, looking for decisions that can deal with the PFAS problem.
So in 2018, we filed a new case in federal court in Ohio where we were seeking to represent everyone in the country who had at least PFOA, the one we already knew was linked with these different diseases, mixed with at least one other PFAS chemical like PFOS, the chemical 3M had been using in Scotch Guard and firefighting foams, and to require medical studies and testing be funded by the companies that had put these chemicals into our blood.
The next step was getting the class action suit certified. Certification is the process of defining the class of people who've suffered the injury. In this case, the court said the class couldn't include every American, but it could include everyone in Ohio. That wasn't great news for Rob, but instead of America, he'd take Ohio. But in an unusual move, the companies appealed the certification, arguing that 10 million people in Ohio was too large a class, and it had potential high financial costs for the companies.
The appellate court accepted the argument from the defendants that this case shouldn't be allowed to proceed because, after all, we don't know where these chemicals are coming from that are getting into these people's blood. We haven't been able to show which specific company put which specific chemicals in people's blood.
That argument makes Rob's blood boil.
There's only one company in this planet that ever made one of these chemicals, PFOS, here in the United States. That same company had the patent on PFOA for decades. And then the other companies were the ones who made PFOA. So it's no mystery, where these chemicals are coming from, and those were the companies we were suing.
Rob continues to work to get the case back on track, and he has many other cases involving U.S. states suing the companies. Rob's law firm was hired by the state of Ohio to sue DuPont for dumping more than 500,000 pounds of PFAS chemicals into the Ohio River. The settlement from DuPont was $110 million. There are estimates that DuPont and 3M, who actually created the chemicals, are facing more than 15,000 lawsuits. Rob thinks the cost to the companies may end up being more than all the tobacco litigation. That litigation cost the tobacco industry more than $240 billion. And tobacco is not banned. So the EPA hasn't moved to ban PFAS, but in 2022, both the U.S. Center for Disease Control and the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine sent a notice to doctors suggesting they should now consider testing their patients' blood for PFAS chemicals.
Beautiful.
Back in Diane Cotter's office in Ringe, New Hampshire, her dog Coco is insisting it's time for Diane to play with her.
Beautiful.
As soon as Diane found out about PFAS in her husband Paul's firefighting turnout gear, she wanted to sue the manufacturers and the chemical producers. This was in 2015.
I had been contacting lawyers for ages in regards to this, but the science wasn't there. The science wasn't there.
After she worked with nuclear physicist Graham Peasley and had the science to show PFAS shedding off the outside of the firefighting suit and very likely doing the same thing on the inside lining, she went back to contacting lawyers. Rob Bilott couldn't take the case because he already had his class action lawsuit. But the success of Rob's earlier case on the DuPont water contamination had got the attention of lawyers who were willing to take Paul's case. Before the case was filed in February of 2022, Paul and the other 9 firefighters who wanted to be part of the lawsuit had their blood tested.
And we thought, well, he probably won't have anything left in him, you know, because it's been, well, it was 6 years since he had been a firefighter. When the blood work came back and his were very high, his numbers were very high, it was absolutely shocking. We were both shocked because we were thinking there's not going to be anything left in his blood.
Diane was even more convinced that the turnout gear was to blame for the blood results and his prostate cancer.
And I think that's what makes Paul's case so unique, is the minimal use that he had with the AFFF.
AFFF, she's referring to firefighting foam. Not all firefighters use the foam, or they use it very rarely, depending on their assignment.
He says that he does not recall, other than training with AFFF, using AFFF.
Diane says they haven't used Teflon for years, are careful about anything they buy. They had the well water tested when they moved into the house, and it did not have PFAS. There's only one place they can be sure Paul was exposed to PFAS. The blood test results also struck a little fear in Paul and Diane. Did these high PFAS levels in his blood mean he would likely get cancer again?
When he began learning that, you know, this has a half-life in it and it should be out of your body, but it's not out of your body, and it accumulates in your blood and in your organs. And then a new worry became, where else now will it pop up in him? That is a concern because, you know, he gets his PSA tested twice a year to make sure that the cancer hasn't spread anywhere. And we're always on high alert.
Diane continues to fight for firefighters, particularly in Massachusetts, where she has political support from Senator Michael Moore. He's one of many state politicians moving into the regulation gap left by the EPA.
Hey, my name is Michael Moore. I represent the 2nd Worcester Senate District in the state of Massachusetts.
Senator Moore has a long history of working on environmental issues.
I spent 22 years working for the state environmental police, and I investigated environmental crimes. And we investigated violations relative to the illegal storage, disposal of hazardous waste.
And then 18 years ago, he became a senator.
I first learned about PFAS, I'd say like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. The Clean Water Action Committee or Association approached me about filing the legislation on dealing with PFAS in food packaging.
The food packaging legislation is still in play, not law yet. He's also pushing legislation to ban PFAS chemicals in all firefighting gear sold in Massachusetts by 2027. Michael met Diane at a 2023 screening of the documentary Burned. It's a film about her fight to bring attention to PFAS chemicals in firefighting gear.
I thanked him and Jim Hawkins and others who were working on the legislation. And he came down afterwards to the orchestra pit where we were standing. And he said, Diane, we're going to get that legislation through this year.
Despite the slow pace, Senator Moore thinks they'll pass soon because a state task force that studied PFAS has gotten behind the legislation. That's all good and hopeful, he says, but there has to be a faster way to regulate chemicals.
You know, I personally think we should go to a process more similar to the FDA for chemicals also. There's no way that we should be allowing chemical companies to develop the different types of chemicals and, should say, the various compounds. I do think we need to find some better way of regulating it.
After decades of being joined at the hip, the Firefighters Union, the International Association of Firefighters, and the National Fire Protection Association had a major falling out in 2023. In the past, some firefighters expressed concerns that the union and the manufacturers were too close. We heard in earlier episodes about how the manufacturers sponsored union conferences. After poring through minutes of meetings, Diane concluded that the manufacturers had too much influence on the decisions made by the National Fire Protection Association, which sets the safety standards. For several years, the union rejected evidence from Diane Cotter and scientist Graham Peasley that the PFAS used by manufacturers in the turnout gear was a danger to firefighters. But in 2021, there was a change of command and a change of direction.
I was hired in the city of Boston in 1997. And I was a United States Air Force firefighter from about June of 1994 till I was hired in Boston in 1997.
Ed Kelly became the general president of the Firefighters Union in March of 2021.
And we represent just shy of 350,000 paid professional firefighters and paramedics throughout North America.
Like most, or maybe all firefighters, Ed Kelly learned about toxic chemicals in his firefighting turnout gear from Diane Cotter. And he easily admits that the union's response was to shoot the messenger, and that was Diane.
She was the absolute hero, and she initially was vilified for speaking truth to power. And that includes some of the leadership in the IFF. It includes some of the IFF committee members in the NFPA. And it, of course, drew the ire of the industry that ultimately has tremendous exposure and liability.
Ed ran for president, he says, not just because the union had its head in the sand over PFAS.
I didn't run for office over PFAS in the bunker gear. I ran for a whole host of other reasons. But by cleaning out the leadership that had those beholdings outside of the best interest of the membership, it gave us that clean ability to do the next right thing for our members, not have to worry about other interests that we might be beholden to.
The Fire Protection Association sets the standards for the equipment, tools, and clothing that keeps firefighters safe. Every manufacturer of turnout gear has to get the stamp of approval from the National Fire Protection Association, the NFPA, before fire chiefs will buy the gear. There's one key assessment the NFPA does to test the strength of the gear. It's called the ultraviolet light degradation test. This accelerates the aging of the moisture barrier. That's the one inside the suit. If the moisture barrier doesn't degrade or break down as a result of the exposure to the light, it will receive the NFPA accreditation. This is a mandatory test, and no turnout gear can get approval without passing it. The problem? Only PFAS-produced gear has been able to pass that test. Since Diane's discovery of PFAS chemicals in the gear, there have been calls for an end to the test, so that replacement gear can be approved for firefighter use. The issue came before the NFPA Technical Committee in 2021, and the committee refused to change the standard. It said without the ultraviolet test, the moisture barrier in the gear could be weakened and put firefighters in danger. When Ed became president, the union began to fight for the removal of PFAS from the gear and the end of the ultraviolet test that could prevent that renewal. In March of 2023, the union sued the NFPA for refusing to get rid of that standard.
The International Association of Firefighters is suing the National Fire Protection Association, the group that sets the standard for fire safety gear. The union says the standard calls for cancer-causing PFAS, or so-called forever chemicals, to be infused into the protective gear.
Ed Kelly stood outside the Massachusetts courthouse to announce the lawsuit.
The most consistent exposure we get to carcinogens is when we put on our PPE every day. The number one killer of firefighters is cancer.
When I spoke to Ed, I asked him why fire chiefs don't just say, no, we won't buy this anymore.
Most chiefs or cities or towns would say, that's just going to open us up to liability if someone gets burned. They're going to turn around and sue us. Say, why didn't you have an NFPA standard get?
And why sue the regulator? Why not sue the manufacturers?
If you're a manufacturer, you are building a product that you were contracted to build. And if it was contracted to be built to the NFPA standard, then it was going to have PFAS.
The NFPA was clearly angry that the lawsuit suggested its regulations demanded that PFAS be used in the turnout gear. It put out a news release saying the standard for the turnout gear does not specify or require the use of any specific materials or chemicals.
It does require a moisture barrier test to ensure the gear will protect the wearer. The manufacturer decides how to comply with that test.
And the NFPA accused the union of doing nothing to get rid of PFAS in the gear.
At no point has the IAFF, or anyone else for that matter, recommended language to the technical committee that would prohibit the use of PFAS in firefighter protective gear. We won't allow our organization, our people, or our valued volunteers to be disparaged or our long-standing process to be politicized by a meritless lawsuit.
It will likely be years before the lawsuit is settled or even gets to court. In the meantime, some manufacturers have already produced turnout gear without PFAS chemicals. This new material is said to be as protective as the old, and it doesn't contain PFAS. Graham Peasley, the nuclear physicist who worked with Diane, has been asked to test the new material companies are using, and they have passed his testing. No PFAS. Graham isn't surprised that a substitute was created. When there's demand, the companies just have to work a little harder to find the right materials.
They're now all four of them switching to this new fabric. And the whole industry has changed. And it's only been a year so far, but within 10 years, all this gear will cycle out. So the next generation of firefighters won't have PFAS in their clothing, and they'll be just as safe as before.
And until then, firefighters are handling their turnout gear very differently.
I think the firefighters now know that, well, I've got to treat this gear with respect. I don't really want to take it home and put it on my kids for a cute photo.
And no longer wear it all day as they wait for a call.
The only thing that happened is DuPont or its subsidiary is making less money than it used to because they're not selling as much of that chemical. But the textile manufacturers are doing just fine. They switched.
And this new gear will likely get NFPA certification because in 2024, the NFPA is finally changing the standard. Toxicologist Linda Birnbaum says regulators move too slowly, but the market can turn on a dime. The market is a powerful regulator. If people stop buying, then industry changes. She uses California as an example of both good regulation and a powerful market.
People just say, I don't want that anymore. And if products aren't selling, then the company will no longer make them. In the United States, California is the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. And if California bans something, industry stops making it because they don't want to make things they can't sell in California. But we may want to start asking questions. Do we really need them? You know, I don't really need my hiking boots to be totally water repellent. And if I do, you know, Vaseline, if I spread that over my hiking boots, that'll make them water repellent. Do I really need stain repellent material in my clothing? Not really. You know, I could say if you go back to natural materials, natural products, they're much more stain resistant inherently. For example, you know, wool rugs are relatively stain resistant. And frankly, a little bit of salt will get out your red wine, and some, you know, club soda will get out almost all stains. No big deal, really. Kind of my ending question is, why do we continue to make chemicals that'll never go away?
Lawyer Rob Bellott.
And for, you know, we're fortunate that in the United States, we had that option, that we had the ability to go into the courts and get this kind of relief. We were able to get this stopped. We were able to get filtration systems put on. We were able to get through trials, you know, people compensated who had gotten cancer. That only occurred through the legal system. And again, all of this is happening while the regulatory process is still to this day dragging on.
Diane and Paul Carter are also waiting for their day in court, ensuring the fight remains on their mind. You know, a lot of times when people have come through something really difficult, people will ask them, if you knew now what you knew then about how hard it was going to be, would you have started?
No, absolutely not. No, no. If I knew then, oh God, no. No, Paul and I have given up 10 years. It was so hard. I can't get those 10 years back.
I know, as you said, you're not finished yet. You still got the lawsuit, but have you and Paul started to, what's the word?
Recover?
Recover.
Yes. Yes, we have. We truly have. I think that a lot of healing happened in January 2023. And that was when the new president of the IAFF recognized us so publicly and with such gratitude when he premiered, burned in front of 2,300 firefighters.
Here is IAFF President Ed Kelly.
But we need heroes too. And I said it in that film. And Diane Carter is our hero. People tried to shut her down. And I know firsthand they went through a lot, the Carters. And I thank both of you for your courage. And Paulie, thank God you're doing well. Keep kicking that cancer's ass.
You know, it wasn't one person. It was an army. It was an army. So if I did anything, it was to build an army.
There are some voices absent from this podcast, particularly on the regulatory side in Canada. I asked for interviews with Health Canada, Transport Canada, Environment Canada, and the Department of Defense. They all refused to talk to me for the podcast. We've come to the end of the first episodes of The Poison Detectives, the story of PFAS and its toxicity, and how it was hidden from us for decades, may have remained a secret much longer if it wasn't for Diane Carter, Rob Bellott, and Graham Peasley, The Poison Detectives. There are more Poison Detectives out there, exposing the regulatory weaknesses in the fight against plastic and pesticides, and the chemicals that interfere with our hormones and the brains of the growing fetus. As with PFAS chemicals, these detectives are up against industry money and industry lobbyists. Like toxicologist Linda Birnbaum, Pediatric epidemiologist Bruce Lanphier has been inside the room when regulators in Canada have faltered because of industry pushback.
You can have different people read the same studies, and some of them will say, well, it's a good probability that this chemical causes this or that. And other groups, we can call them the minimizers, will read those same studies and say, there's lots of limitations of these studies, or there's lots of uncertainty, or other studies find no association. What's unfortunate, what's troubling, not that industry is a minimizer, we expect that. But what's troubling is that our regulators tend to be minimizers. If there's a single study, then our regulators should step up and start to act, whatever that might mean for that particular chemical. For pesticides, it might simply mean, can we begin to find ways to reduce the amount of pesticides used in Canada? Right? Doesn't have to mean banning them, but that even a single study, if you truly wanted to protect public health, if our regulators wanted to protect public health, how would they be different? Well, they certainly wouldn't be minimizers. And they certainly wouldn't wait decades for dozens and dozens of studies to confirm what studies may have found 20 or 30 or 40 years ago.
I hope to be back with those stories soon. This kind of narrative podcasting takes time, and taking time means it costs money. So once I find the funding, I'll bring you more stories. The podcast is researched, written, and produced by me, Sandra Bartlett. Story editing by Backtrack Productions. Production assistance by Zara Kozema and David Mackay. The executive producer is Linda Solomon Wood. This podcast received additional support from Creative BC and the province of British Columbia. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. That helps people find us. And I love reading your comments. Thanks for listening.